Rudema, who will talk about gene auctions in quantum mechanics and spectral sequences and the cosmological constant.
So thanks a lot for inviting me to speak here. Right. So this talk is not exactly about BV formalism, but it is about homological concepts and about boundary conditions. So hopefully close enough to the themes. I wanted to tell you about some recent work with Andy Knightsky and David Bensby. In our discussions and in discussions with a few of the people here, we've been trying to take a rather abstract mathematical information coming from, well, the way mathematicians look at TQFTs and the cobordism hypothesis and these EN structures of algebras and trying to EN structures of operator algebras and trying to just very concretely say what they mean in physical theories, coming myself from sort of a quantum field theorist viewpoint. So this is one such exercise. The theme, you could say, is homological G-actions. And theories, which are maybe things that you guys already know a lot about, but I'm going to be incredibly basic and tell you about them anyway. The simplest occurrence of homological G-actions is in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which is, in my mind, the simplest quantum field theory. So I'm going to focus on that example throughout the talk today, but there are, well, hopefully you will see that there are many ways to generalize to higher dimensions and more interesting theories. And I should also say, before I forget, that one of the things Konstantin Telemann has been doing for the last several years is sort of implementing homological G-actions in Shukaya categories, which is could be viewed as a version of the story one dimension up. Okay, so yeah. So the plan is to tell you a little bit about supersymmetric quantum mechanics, review basics, and then I'll talk about global symmetries. So I'll talk about global symmetries and gauged symmetries. So the gauge story is extremely old. It leads to equivariant cohomology, and I'll say that very briefly. The global story is the part that in physics is new and unappreciated. In mathematics, a lot of what I will be saying is an application of a paper of Gorsky, Kotwitz, and McPherson on, well, equivariance and G-actions and causal duality. So it turns out that gauge and global actions are related by causal duality. And in physics, the nicest way to implement that is to go up one dimension and think about boundary conditions for two-dimensional quantum field theory. Try to explain the physics there, and then there's a really, well, the causal duality statement actually tells you very precisely how to gauge and ungauge symmetries in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which I think physically is interesting on its own. in physics, one often thinks it's very easy to gauge a symmetry, but once you've gauged it, you've lost it. And this is an example where you know exactly what information you need to keep around to remove the gauging. And then there's another cute application at the end, which has to do with a mechanism for supersymmetry breaking, with the feature that one adds an order one deformation to the action, lifting vacuum energy classically at order one, whereas the quantum vacuum energy is lifted at arbitrarily high order, depending on how the construction is engineered, and that all comes by understanding 2 and 3. So I think of this as sort of a toy model of resolving the cosmological constant problem. I don't think it's practically extremely useful, but it's sort of nice. All right, so supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Let me recall some facts that were set out in a paper of Witten's in 1982. So ordinary bosonic quantum mechanics is about a particle moving on some Riemannian manifold Y, and I will always assume this is compact to simplify the talk. Quantum mechanics is often reformulated as a one-dimensional quantum field theory whose fields are maps from time to the particle, and or time to y, and just describe the trajectory of this particle. And then one proceeds to describe a phase space . So this is collections. Well, it's the space of solutions to the equations of motion on a very small interval. You can think of it as positions and momenta of the particle at some fixed time, which then enable you to solve the equations of motion geometrically. Get the cotangent bundle of y, and then the Hilbert space gets identified upon canonical quantization with L2 functions on the space y itself. Now, one of the first things one asks for in a quantum mechanics problem is, what are the ground states? What are the lowest energy states? And here in particular, I should have said, so we have a Hilbert space, there's a Hamiltonian acting on it, which measures energy or generates time evolution. The Hamiltonian acts as the Laplacian, and then the ground states are states the lowest possible energy ground states are states where the energy is zero, and these are identified as harmonic functions. So if y is compact, harmonic functions are not very interesting. There's one, it's a constant. And the story gets interesting with supersymmetry. So supersymmetric quantum mechanics. There are several versions of supersymmetric quantum mechanics, depending on what sort of supersymmetric multiplets the fields sit in. The one I'll talk about is just the one Witten talked about in his paper on this, where the target is, the bosonic part of the target is still Riemannian. It's sometimes called Durham quantum mechanics for a reason that will become clear in a second. So what happens when you add supersymmetry? The most important upshot is that the phase space gets enhanced from the cotangent bundle of y to the cotangent bundle of the shifted tangent bundle of y. So with supersymmetry, one adds fermions that transform as sections of the tangent bundle. Canonical quantization then produces a Hilbert space that's functions on the base. In other words, differential forms on y. These are complex valued differential forms. And if y were not compact, I would say L2 differential forms. But I'm going to gloss over that. The Hamiltonian is now the form Laplacian. And so the ground states, the ground states are harmonic forms. Now, in a supersymmetric theory, there are more operators than the Hamiltonian acting on the Hilbert space. So abstractly, we have an entire supersymmetry algebra. Generated by two supercharges that are Hermitian conjugates. They're adjoint operators acting on the Hilbert space that commute to H. Explicitly, these are realized as the D and D dagger operators. Exterior derivative and its adjoint. And there's a famous expression for the form Laplacian that's the anticommutator of the exterior derivative and its adjoint. In a supersymmetric theory, one doesn't just ask for ground states, one asks for supersymmetric ground states. Which abstractly means not only does H vanish, but Q and Q bar acting on a ground state vanish. Here, we identify supersymmetric ground states with harmonic forms. They are, in this case, because this is a rather simple relation, asking H to vanish is equivalent to asking Q and Q bar to vanish. So this is omega harmonic. And then Witten gave a purely abstract argument that in this space should be equivalent to Durham cohomology, well, not to Durham cohomology, but to cohomology of the entire Hilbert space with a differential, either Q or Q bar. Mathematically, in this particular example, this is the Hodge theorem. So here it's the Hodge theorem, but under certain assumptions, the statement is completely general. There is some abstract algebra like this with a Q and Q bar. generating the Hamiltonian, and then if you want ground states of the Hamiltonian, you look at Q cohomology. Right. That's supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So the goal now is to introduce global symmetry. So suppose we have a group acting on Y via Hamiltonian, via Riemannian isometries. And I'm going to suppose that G is a compact Lie group. This story is interesting when G is a continuous group. The sort of action on the target Y gives rise most basically to what's known as a flavor symmetry in supersymmetric quantum mechanics. It's a particular kind of global symmetry. What does that actually mean? So, well, on general grounds, the Hilbert space should be a representation of G. And indeed, G acts on forms via pull back or push forward. Moreover, the infinitesimal action is generated by Lie derivatives. Where V is some element of the dual Lie algebra, tensored vector fields on Y. And there are a few nice identities involving the Lie derivative. It commutes with D&D dagger. Physically, we would say it commutes with supersymmetry. And commuting with supersymmetry is the definition of a flavor symmetry, as opposed to an R symmetry. This implies that LV is a chain map. This, by definition, means LV is a chain map. On the Durham complex, and you find that LV acts, or more precisely, the Lie algebra of G acts on Durham cohomology. It acts on the supersymmetric ground states. So the ground states should be a representation of G. But this representation of G is not talked about very often in physics. And the reason why is that the Lie derivative is also Q exact. So it's the anti-commutator of D in something and the anti-commutator of D dagger in something, and that something is contraction with the vector field V. So it's Cartan's formula. So this implies that the Lie derivative actually acts as zero on the cohomology of Y. And just to make that explicit, we have a closed form, LV of omega is D of IV of omega. Hence, it's equivalent to zero. OK, so we don't talk about this representation because it's trivial. So the statement is, whenever you have quantum supersymmetric quantum mechanics with a G symmetry, the supersymmetric ground states are a trivial representation of, well, if I take this literally, of the Lie algebra. And the interesting part is that even though they're a trivial representation of the Lie algebra, they're still a non-trivial representation of the group G. So how do we get that? Well, anything interesting happening with G has to do with its global structure, because in infinitesimally, everything is zero. There are a few different ways of defining the global G action. The upshot is that the homology of G, the thing that senses its global structure, has the structure or gains the structure of an exterior algebra. And is the thing that ends up acting on the cohomology of Y. So in case you have not seen that before, let me explain how it goes. So we had that formula that acting on a closed form, LV was D of IV. And we can apply the same methodology that one applies in the method of descent. Descent in anomaly equations or descent in TQFT. This is descent on the group. So if LV of omega is D of something, you remove a D and observe that IV of omega looks like a one form on G. So given a one cycle, we can integrate. So we can define gamma of omega to be, I'm going to be rough in the notation here, but it's the integral over gamma of IV of omega. And literally what I mean by this is an averaging or a smearing over gamma of IV omega, so there should be some extra pullback in there. This is an average. A more canonical way to say it is that if we have our group action, phi, going from G cross Y to Y, we also have the projection, the trivial action, going from G cross Y to Y. So this is just projection. We can define this action by taking a one form, or sorry, by taking any form on Y, pulling it back to G cross Y, wedging with the Poincaré dual of some homology cycle. So this is.
So phi is a projection, or it's. You have to.
Phi is the group action. So we pull back by the group action and then push forward trivially. And the push forward is an integration along the fibers of G. It's what implements this integral. And just define that to be gamma of omega. And that definition makes sense for any omega. This operation takes forms to forms. And checking carefully, it commutes with D and D dagger. Sorry, it commutes with D. So it's a chain map. So these gamma operations act on cohomology. And they lead to the statement I wanted, statement I claimed. So the gammas act on the dynamical homology of Y. So let me give you an example. Give you two. So let's just take Y to be the circle. This has a U1 acting. If we consider any form on the circle, and and let U1 act by the vector field dd theta. Well, you can check for yourselves that gamma of omega, where gamma is the fundamental class of U1, is just going to be the integral over U1 of B of S. In other words, gamma of d theta is up to a factor of 2 pi, volume of the group is 1, and gamma of 1 is 0. To illustrate that differently, the forms on a circle come in degree 0, come in degree 0 and in degree 1 with a differential that way and a gamma operation going back. The cohomology has two copies of C. D is gone, but we still have gamma going back. And so the claim is that supersymmetric quantum mechanics on a circle has this exterior algebra always acting on it. Now, let me give you another example. So if we take,
So you wrote two different definitions for gamma, I think, or omega.
Yes.
So the previous one, you have also the vector field V. Right? And the second one.
That's right. It did. So I think, the second one is probably a better general definition. The first one was, I was trying to illustrate that the action comes from the fact that the Lie derivative is trivialized in cohomology, but not at the chain level. V was totally general though. So V was just, it wasn't a specific vector field. It was valued in the dual of the Lie algebra.
Yes.
So yes, there's a V, but I have made no choice in saying what V was. The only thing that matters is what cycle I integrate.
Yes.
I integrate that on, and so the operation only depends on gamma. And
this is, okay, this yeah. is the operation.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me do a more interesting example. So suppose we have S3 viewed as the Hopf vibration. With again a U1 action that rotates the fibers. Then what ends up happening is we have forms in degrees 0, 1, 2, 3. And cohomology, of course, just has two copies of C in degrees 0 and 3. And then you can ask, what does the gamma operation do? Well, it's going to take the top form in cohomology to a two form. And that's, there are no two forms in cohomology, so naively that thing is zero. And indeed, just the ordinary gamma action on cohomology is zero. But precisely because there's no cohomology here, D is invertible. And we can use D inverse to pass to one forms and then hit them with gamma again and actually get down to zero forms. So even though gamma itself doesn't do anything, gamma D inverse gamma does. And it remains an operation on cohomology. Right, so two things to say. First, I've sort of just stated how this works for S3. There's a lovely geometric way to think about this, which is to define the analogous operations in homology rather than cohomology. So if you think about homology of S3, you can start with a point, and then applying gamma sweeps the point out along the action of U1. It sweeps the point out into a fiber. And then applying D inverse means, well, that fiber should be the boundary of a disk, so fill the disk in. And then you apply gamma again, and this requires a bit of imagination with the hop vibration. If you have a disk in the hop vibration, you can sweep out the disk using the U1 action to actually fill out the entire S3. So this is sort of, you push it out this way, and then it comes around the bottom, and you've got all of S3. So that's gamma D inverse gamma, but in homology. Okay.
Miss a circle or something?
Sorry?
Do you miss a circle?
No, you really get everything.
It seems like you get a torus from that, like a solid torus.
The boundary of that disk is the first circle that you swept out, which is the core of that.
You have.
I got a really nice picture of the hop vibration from an IAS newsletter, but I think it's also the picture that it's on Wikipedia. So if you just look up hop vibration on Wikipedia, you can see, in particular, you can see this circle very, very clearly.
Okay, but whatever gamma D inverse gamma is, it is not an element of the homology of this.
Absolutely not. So So how do we deal with this? But you know how you deal with this.
You told me that the homology of S1 acts. You didn't tell me.
But there's a better statement. So the better statement is that the supersymmetric ground states in quantum mechanics are a DG module for the homology of G. Maybe more accurately, the entire Hilbert space is a DG module for the homology of G. So forms on Y are homology of G DG modules.
Can you say infinity string? I mean, in this particular example. What you said is totally correct. Okay.
What do you mean by DG? Sorry, you need to explain.
Yeah. So specifically, I mean, you should think of forms, well, as a differential graded vector space, which you already do. It's graded by fermion number, and it has a differential. And the action of the homology of G actually operates on chains. One physical relevance, which at least helped me understand mathematically what this meant, is that thinking of this as a DG module constrains how much you can simplify it. So in the case of S1, we could just pass to cohomology and think of the ground states as two copies of C. That mathematically passing to the cohomology, well, let me say that better. In quantum mechanics, let me take that back. What I actually want to say is that in neither of these cases does there exist a supersymmetric U1 preserving deformation of the theory that leaves behind two copies of C. And the thing that's preventing a deformation of the theory that leaves behind two copies of C is this simple gamma operation here and the higher gamma operation over here. So
higher gamma is an infinite module, actually. The second operation of an infinite module.
Yes.
You take the DG module and you take it to cohomology.
Yes. So as I've been taught by various friends, one has two options when thinking about DG modules. Either you take the entire chain complex, or if you want sort of a maximal simplification of the chain complex. So in the case of S3, a maximal simplification would involve at least four copies of C that still have the entire chain present. Or you pass to cohomology, but you include higher operations. And so you can work with something extremely simple, but then there's all this extended structure around. And then you don't just think of it as, well, you think of it as A infinity modules for the homology of G, or modules for some bigger algebra formed out of the homology of G. So the thing about supersymmetric deformations is kind of neat, and I should watch my time. So literally, like in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, you can turn on Morse functions, you can do all sorts of stuff to simplify the theory. Ideally, you want to simplify the theory to the extent that it has just isolated massive vacuum. And this is saying there's absolutely no way you can do that while preserving the U1 action.
Can you deform? In the strict case, you need simple deformation to the four C's.
Question.
If you find a Morse function, which is U1,
yeah, symmetric,
and has four critical points on the flow.
That'd be really nice.
Yeah, you just made a negative statement of what you cannot do. Is there a way to turn it around and make a positive statement about what these things allow you, or where it leads?
If all the higher operations vanish, then
it's
a negative statement.
Does it deform the U1 action, or is there, where is it leading? Does that mean that you have to?
I think it's a no-go statement. That's
Does it give you a sense of how to open it up again, or no?
I think so.
Okay.
Right. So let me.
So why is it important then? In some sense. Trying to relate to why. Because clearly it has some relevance.
Yeah. I'm not sure what to say, but let me go on. I should get at least a few more things out before the end of the talk. So that was global symmetry. Let me review very quickly what happens with gauge symmetry. What does gauge symmetry mean? Well, in general, if there's a symmetry mathematically, you should introduce a principal bundle with connection on your spacetime. And I secretly did that in the global symmetry case. I just set the connection to zero. And then I looked at gauge transformations that preserved the zero connection. And these were that was G as a global symmetry. So here, I introduce a principal bundle with connection, and I integrate over all possible connections. In the path integral, but the theory is supersymmetric, so it's a principal super G bundle. and I'm integrating over superconnections that come in multiplets of the supersymmetry algebra. And the most interesting part of that is a complex Lie algebra valued scalar that becomes a field of the gauge theory. So sitting inside the supersymmetry representation that contains the connection, there's a complex Lie algebra valued scalar. Then one goes through the same calculations to find the Hilbert space of the theory. The Hilbert space is this statement is a suitably simplified version of the Hilbert space, is forms on the target tensored with polynomials in sigma, G invariant, and then the supersymmetric ground states become identified with cohomology of this thing with a differential that's D plus sigma IV, and that leads to the Cartan model for equivariant cohomology. So this is G equivariant cohomology of Y. And G equivariant cohomology of Y is itself a module. In a more familiar way, G equivariant cohomology of Y just has an action of polynomials in sigma. Which is the G equivariant cohomology of a point. And this is a standard module action. There's nothing homological or DG about it. We could trivially make this a DG module. So then we get the following sort of thing. So on one hand, with the global symmetry, the cohomology of Y, or more accurately, forms on Y, are a homology of G, DG module, whereas in the gauge theory, equivariant cohomology of Y is an equivariant cohomology of a point, trivially DG module.
Is there any situation where the DG cannot be removed on the island side, or is it always trivial?
I think for a symmetric algebra, it is always trivial.
Just go back to the time tree for a moment. Do you mind writing negativity on the left?
What?
Well, the whole discussion before was cohomology of Y.
No. But I actually mean.
Or you could just like put the golden letter A infinity and not worry about it.
Make it very small.
Yeah.
No, continue to be more.
So far, I have seen no serious reason to actually think about things as A infinity. I think it's much more natural to just take the entire chain complex and think about it as DG. Okay. So here, there's a symmetric algebra acting. Here, there's an exterior algebra acting. And I'll identify it more precisely in a second. But you can generate this entire exterior algebra by taking gauge invariant polynomials not in a bosonic Lie algebra element, but in a fermionic Lie algebra element. So GC shifted by one. So in cohomology, this element is the more Cartan form on the group, and it generates the cohomology, and I'm doing some Poincaré duality here. So there are these two pictures. The nice mathematical statement is that these categories are equivalent. So that's Kozul duality. These are Kozul dual symmetric and exterior algebras. The physical implication of the statement that those are equivalent is precisely that one can gauge and ungauge at will. If one keeps track of the action of sigma here and the action of lambda or the gamma operations over there, there's a rather nice way to visualize the eraser. ask the audience. There's also a nice way to visualize the fact that you can gauge and ungauge at will. Whenever there is a symmetry in a theory, it is natural to think of it as a boundary condition for quantum field theory in one dimension higher. So in this case, we want to think of supersymmetric quantum mechanics as a boundary condition for two-dimensional 2,2 pure gauge theory. Now, what I actually mean by this is the A twist. So it is a two-dimensional TQFT, and some boundary conditions in this theory are labeled by Riemannian manifolds Y with a G action. In fact, so any Riemannian manifold Y with a G action provides a boundary condition. And so there's a category. Boundary conditions whose objects I'm going to call Y. Now, in this category, you can compute Helms. And that computation is the only thing you actually need to go ahead and derive the entire TG module structure and the Kozul duality statement. So what is the Helm in this category? If I have two boundary conditions X and Y, the Hilbert space of states on a strip is the same as what I would get by colliding the two sides of the strip. I'll just get quantum mechanics with target X times Y that has a gauge symmetry. So this is GF invariant cohomology of X times Y.
Do you have some orientations?
I do. I'm not being careful about that. So when thinking about cohomology thinking about states as forms, there are Hodge duals and complex conjugations happening. They will be happening all around. Not paying close attention. It's important for explaining how Helm spaces multiply. That's where you need to be careful about that, and that's where the Hodge duals are. Okay, there's that statement, and then there are two.
Are you going to explain how Helm spaces multiply?
No. There are two canonical boundary conditions in pure gauge theory. One of them in physics would be called Neumann. That's, in this language, the boundary condition labeled by a point. And if we look at a sandwich with Neumann on one side and Y on the other, we end up with gauged quantum mechanics with target Y. So we get equivariant cohomology of point cross Y, which we can identify as equivariant cohomology of Y.
So this is a frame, it's not a frame topological.
No.
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 There's no non-homology, of course, and that seems to be
right. Just because it's pure, it's pure data. It's like the B model of the C.
Yes.
So there's a Dirichlet boundary condition, which physically we would say is breaking the gauge symmetry at the boundary, and that's that. But in this language, it's better to resolve breaking the gauge symmetry on the boundary to coupling to a copy of G. And then the gauge symmetry is broken spontaneously, because any point on G has a trivial isotropy group. Stabilized. So the Dirichlet boundary condition can be realized as coupling to G, and then this should give ungauged global symmetry quantum mechanics on Y, and we check. We get G equivariant cohomology of G cross Y, which can be made equivalent to cohomology of Y in a slightly non-trivial way. What else? Well, there's an endomorphism algebra of Neumann.
So does H stat G of G times Y give you a model for a finite dimensional model for the complex?
Yes.
Which does not?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it's the resolution that you need. So the endomorphism algebra of Neumann is equivariant cohomology of point cross point, which is equivariant cohomology of point, which is this C of sigma. And this is coming, this sigma is literally a field in the two-dimensional gauge multiplet that's being restricted to the boundary. The endomorphism algebra of Dirichlet is dot dot dot, ends up being the cohomology of G, which dualized the cohomology of G, which is the exterior algebra that I was talking about all along. And there's a fermion lambda involved, and lambda is a gauge, you know. It's, again, a field in the two-dimensional gauge multiplet that's being restricted to lambda. And then all of the actions and sites come from some sort of convolution. They come from multiplying these Hom spaces. Visually, I think of them as operators on one boundary that are acting on the Hilbert space. And then the Quazil duality statement is sitting in the picture. Looks like this, where I have, say, Dirichlet on one side and Neumann on the other. Neumann on one side and Dirichlet on the other. And Y over here. Now, what can go between Dirichlet and Neumann? What is this thing? It's an element of Hom UG. In other words, G equivariant cohomology of point cross G. So I can say that's isomorphic to cohomology of a point, which is C, and indeed there's a unique thing that goes here, but it is, as always, important to keep track of this as a complex, and to actually So if you keep track of this thing as a complex, then you multiply Hom's to get from gauged quantum mechanics to ungauged quantum mechanics. So I'm almost out of time. Any questions on this? Now let's say yes.
How did you compute the boundary condition from there?
I used a state operator correspondence, and I flared this out.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So it becomes the same as the previous calculations you were doing.
Up to some dualization. Yeah.
What do you get if you put G over H as a boundary?
it's clear what you mean. How should we break?
Yeah, well, what is the onomorphism?
Not in the picture. Let me wrap up quickly. So, and there is one final application to this, which if you are interested in, ask me about mainly during the break later. But let me give you a flavor for it. So, in the Gorsky Kotlitz McPherson work on this equivalence that they did not phrase it in terms of DG modules, they computed equivariant cohomology starting from these gamma actions on the global side. And there's a spectral sequence that relates ordinary cohomology to equivariant cohomology. So the differential just gets deformed. In the Tarton model, it gets deformed by P equals IP. The differentials in the spectral sequence are precisely the gamma operations and the higher gamma operations. So, in particular, if all of the gamma operations vanish on this side, then the equivariant cohomology on this side is just going to be polynomials in sigma times the ordinary cohomology. It's this situation that is called equivariantly formal. The case where the gamma operations are highly non-trivial leads to the interesting model of supersymmetry breaking. This involves introducing a twisted mass in the theory. Mathematically, what it means is that we're going to look at a Hilbert space. So there's a deformation of the theory where you take this sigma and fix it to be a constant. It's a deformation of the Dirichlet boundary condition. And so I have no time, let me just say quickly what sort of thing I'm looking for. So I want to fix sigma to be some constant m. What that effectively means in terms of the Hilbert space or the ground states is that I take G equivariant cohomology of Y, well, and invert sigma. It's something stupid. Or if you think of G equivariant cohomology as fibered over the sigma space, I'm just taking a fiber at a particular value of sigma. Now, if the G action is free, then this thing is empty. Because this is finite dimensional as a sigma module, the G action is free, and I get nothing. That means supersymmetry is broken. Now, as a physicist, how I see supersymmetry is broken is by looking at the Lagrangian, and we're looking at the action of the theory, and noticing that there's a term, M times the norm of the vector field squared integrated over space. And if this is a free G action, the vector field never vanishes, and this term never vanishes, and I've just lifted the vacuum energy at order m squared.
So the classical vacuum energy is of order m squared. There are no ground states. There are no supersymmetric ground states. The interesting thing is to look at the quantum vacuum energy. So what about the lowest eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian of the theory, which is d plus m iv commuted with d dagger plus m bar iv dagger? This is some equivariant version of the Laplacian. And the new result, which is a fairly simple generalization of the Hodge theorem using spectral sequences, is that this lowest eigenvalue is of order n to the 2n if the spectral sequence from ordinary cohomology of Y to this thing, to nothing, is still non-trivial at the nth page. So in other words, if it takes if the spectral sequence converges only after n steps. So a good way to visualize that, if you take a very high dimensional odd sphere, something like S17, supersymmetric quantum mechanics on S17 has two ground states, one in degree 0 and one in degree 17. When you turn on this little deformation by m, you're deforming the differential from d to d plus miv. But the miv can't immediately, so you know that at the end of the day there are no supersymmetric ground states left, but the miv naively can only lower the degree of the top form by 1. And so you have to sort of go to very high order perturbation theory to see that the 17 form and the 0 form actually get connected and can interact in such a way that lifts their energy. So what you find for the 17 sphere is that the vacuum energy is of order m to the 36, which is kind of nice. Thanks.
Questions for the speakers?
This is A model with target like T star BG?
Yeah.
Is that?
It's not T star. It's just BG. You want it to be
simplified.
It's the complex something
or
other. It's the complex effect group that's playing a role. I don't know how that helps with BG.
I have a question about this lift from one to, higherly. Usually, can I think of it as in the other way around? Like when I have a theory in a higher dimension and I look at the edge mode or the corner turns, in the gauge theory, there's edge modes appearing and usually they have some kind of dynamics. Is that the reverse of that operation or it's completely disconnected? Usually, if I have a theory in higher dimension D, and it's a gauge theory, there will be edge mode appearing in co-dimension 2. And it means that the boundaries needs to be put a dynamics in some sense. If you want to have this is related to what was the previous talk.
It's a topological twist, that's
it. I'm not saying it. Okay. So the answer is no, or I'm just saying that we use there's a way to have a bulk theory, which from which we derive a boundary theory, and here you're doing the reverse. So I'm asking whether these operations are in some sense inverse to each other, or they have nothing in relationships, or in the previous talk we had you know, we were presented the other option, the corner option.
So I'm not immediately sure. I don't think I want to be pinned down to an answer. But the principle physically that's at play doesn't necessarily have to do with topological theories. It's just any theory of the G symmetry. But if the physical statement that is that if you can couple it to G gauge theory in one dimension higher, then you can gauge and ungauge. But the physical operations are not necessarily invertible or isomorphic. So once you can couple it to a theory in one dimension higher, then there's another operation you do, which is slapping on a Neumann or Dirichlet boundary condition at the other side. And since it's physical, you actually have to make the strip very small or flow to the IR. And that process has the power to reproduce for you both the gauged and ungauged versions of the lower dimensional theory. Moreover, any module structure, any interesting operator algebras that exist in the lower dimensional theory will come from stuff in the bulk. So
is the bulk always a topological theory, or it could be more general than that?
Yeah, I mean, it needs to be simple enough that the operation of colliding boundary conditions works. So the nicest case, there's a parametric gauge coupling in the bulk, which you can send to zero, which is the same as slapping on a Dirichlet boundary condition. It needs to be simple enough that these operations exist, but I think they will. I think they will exist quite generally. That you don't get extra degrees of freedom with these collisions. So here crucially, it was the minimal gauge theory I could possibly come up with. There was no matter, it had just as much supersymmetry as I needed to have a supersymmetric boundary condition. But these statements make sense non-topologically here.
If not, then before we think tutor, I want to announce that there's a lunch downstairs. There should be tables set up for sort of, they expect some number of people, who it's like the number of people registered on the website. And this afternoon, we will have a discussion, I guess here, because it's probably a big group, where I think the plan is at least to start by kind of trying to get some better sense of in examples from others who stopped this morning. So let's thank Tudor again.